This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Domestic violence used to be a hidden crime, with victims too embarrassed or too scared to report it, and law enforcement reluctant to get involved with what they viewed as a family dispute. Both those attitudes have changed substantially over the years, but there's still work to be done, both to reduce the incidence of domestic violence and to protect and help the victims. We can give you some numbers. For instance, CMPD reported more than 36,000 calls for service in domestic violence-related incidents in 2012, a number which seems to be growing with every passing year, as does the number of confirmed domestic violence incidents. Most victims are female, and their numbers grow each year, but males are also victims, and their numbers, too, are growing. But those are just numbers. Today, we want to try to get a clearer picture of what domestic violence looks like in our state. And to that end, we have invited Julie Owens to join us. She is a domestic violence survivor and the Southern Piedmont Region Director of the North Carolina Council for Women and former chair of the Domestic Violence Advocacy Council. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Mike.
Nice to have you with us. She's in our Spirit Square studio along with Jane Taylor, Jill Dinwiddie, and Kit Gruel. Jane Taylor is the coordinator of the Battered Women Shelter of Charlotte and the former chair of the LGBT Committee of Charlotte. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Jill Dinwiddie is co-founder of the Enough campaign. That's with a capital N-O in the middle of the word Enough, which is trying to bring awareness to the problem. Previously, Jill was the executive director of the North Carolina Council for Women. Thank you for joining us. And Kit Gruel is also a survivor and a documentarian who has worked as an advocate for battered women and their children for 27 years. She has worked with California Post, that state's effort to train law enforcement officers to deal with domestic violence, and she is known nationally as an advocate and a community educator on this topic. And you brought a stack of files, which we'll talk about in a couple of seconds. Thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Mike.
I said in the beginning, we've done many programs on this in the past. I've been doing this a long time. So I said in the beginning that in the past, this was a problem that hid, lurked in the shadows because women or people, the abused, would not come forward because they were embarrassed or they were scared. The police, when they were called, wanted to back away from all of this, and that had changed. Has it changed, and how much has it changed? I don't know who to ask that question of.
Well, I think that we think that it has changed to a degree, but I also think that we think, and I know the women here at the table, that we still have a problem in this country, in North Carolina, here in Charlotte, with victims being stigmatized, with victims being judged, with victims being marginalized. And there's still a lot of really problematic stereotypes that are attached to this. A lot of people tend to think that domestic violence victims are poor and uneducated, that they don't come from middle-class and upper-class families. And after doing this work as an advocate for a long time, I can promise you there are many, many, many women who come from upper and middle-class families who are professional women, lawyers, doctors.
Why do they put up with it?
It's not a matter of putting up with it. This is one of the things that we have to be very clear about. Abusers don't start in a controlling manner. They start oftentimes with being incredibly sweet, incredibly thoughtful, sort of over-attentive. And a lot of times women don't understand that this really sweet guy that they're dating has this potential further on down the road for becoming dangerously controlling. Mm-hmm. And I wish I had a nickel for every time a woman said to me, you know, he wasn't like this when we first started dating. And so it's a tactic. I think we have to be clear that the behaviors that abusers use aren't out of control. They're tactics. They know precisely what they're going to do and when they're going to do it. I mean, think about the last time that there was a murder or murder-suicide here in Charlotte, and the media shows up, and they find the neighbor, you know, tell me about this family. And almost invariably, the neighbor will say, he seemed like such a nice guy.
Right.
And there's a reason for that. You know, he wants to do the controlling behavior behind closed doors and then present a different face to the public.
Where does that come from, this desire to have this controlling behavior? Has anybody researched that or talked to victims or even abusers about where this comes from?
I can tell you what my husband said.
Okay.
Because before we married, he was very kind and loving, and as Kit was saying, just, you know, indulgent and couldn't be nicer, and my friends loved him. And after being married for just a matter of weeks, literally, after he became emotionally and verbally abusive, I was so taken aback. I was so shocked. And I said, why are you doing this? Why didn't you do this before we married? And he looked right at me and he said, you never would have married me. So Kit's absolutely right. It is intentional. It is a way of controlling. It's about power and control, Mike. It's not just about physical violence. In fact, I wasn't even being hit, and I wasn't physically injured until I filed for divorce. And I think that's what's really important for people to realize, is that to be a battered woman doesn't mean that you're getting beat up all the time. You might not even be getting hit, but the emotional abuse, the psychological abuse, the incredible atmosphere of terror that's created, and by being isolated and intimidated and harassed and kept up at night, and it's really like a hostage situation. And I use that analogy a lot when I do training. I think it is like being a hostage, and the terror that's instilled is what keeps us in a relationship until we actually do make that move. And some women, you know, like myself, you know, I left him, you know, within 3 months of the marriage, but I don't think leaving makes anybody safer. It actually endangers them, and that's why it's so important to have services like where Jane works, where an experienced domestic violence advocate can work with someone and do safety planning and help them leave in a safe manner, because society says, just leave, just leave, just leave, and they don't realize that, you know, we have left, we are leaving, we will leave again. But in the meantime, if you don't help us be safe, mm-hmm. we're likely to get hurt worse and maybe even killed.
I want to talk about that because that's very important. Jane Taylor, you mentioned Jane a second ago with the Battered Women's Shelter, and Jill Dinwiddie from the Enough campaign. Are these two women who are survivors, Kit Gruelle and Julie Owens, are their stories the stories that you hear every single day in what you do?
Oh, absolutely. And I think the whole idea that, you know, why don't they do something? They do something all the time. Mm-hmm. They're constantly doing something. They're constantly doing things to make themselves and their children safe. One statistic that I just want to throw out, a census that was taken across the country just recently of services, over 64,000 victims called for services in one day. So the very idea that they're not doing something is just not true. They're coming to shelters in mass, in huge numbers, but many, many of them are turned away because there aren't enough services.
Well, you opened a new, correct me if I'm wrong, you opened a new battered women's shelter, what, 2 years ago?
We opened a new one a month and a half ago.
Okay, and you already have 98 people at
last report?
We
had 98 people Friday. We are an 80-bed facility. We had 98 people Friday.
These are all battered women?
No, they're battered women and their children, yes.
Their children.
We have one man in shelter, yes. They're all battered women and their children, and one man right now, yes. So that's less than 2 months.
It's pretty amazing. Jill Dinwiddie.
Back to your question of where the root cause of this abuse in abusers. And I think that we all feel, and there's some reason to feel, that a lot of these abusers have experienced abuse themselves growing up, or they come from homes where they have witnessed abuse. And if that's the kind of violence that you experience growing up, then you soon come to think that that's the norm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've talked about this before too, the cycle of violence and breaking the cycle of violence. And you would think that after, and I've been doing this, as I said, for a long time, so you'd think after 20 or 25 years of talking about this, we would have made a dent in doing so. Have we?
No.
Is it better or is it not?
Well, part of it is the family unit is still regarded as this private little, you know, governing body.
Mm-hmm.
And we still have a lot of people who believe that, you know, that it's the man's job to govern his family and use whatever tactics he needs to make his family do what he thinks ought to do. And I'm thinking several years ago I went down to Dallas, Georgia to do a class, and there was a woman in the class who co-facilitated the abuser treatment program. And she had just screened a man to come in who had beaten his wife severely. And during the intake process, the man said to this woman who worked with the program, he said, "I don't know what I'm here for. I've got papers on her." So he thought that the marriage license entitled him to beat her and do with her what he wanted. And as long as we have abusers who see their partners as their personal property to do with what they want, and this is not, once again, remember, this is not behavior that only happens in certain parts of the community. There's a very famous case out of Tacoma, Washington that happened several years ago where the police chief, David Brame, his wife separated from him because she couldn't take the domestic violence anymore. She separated from him on a Monday. On the following Friday, when they were exchanging the children in a grocery store parking lot, the chief of police, David Brame, pulled out his gun and shot her in the head and then shot himself in front of the children. So, you know, we just have to understand what it is that's happening behind closed doors and recognize that there needs to be a larger community response, because if it's left up only to law enforcement, if it's left up only to the advocacy community, we need more people. We need more people to be able to understand the dynamics, when they see something, to say something. And this is what the program that Jill's working on is all about. I mean, this is, you know, we can no longer allow this terrorism to go on behind closed doors and go unchecked until you've got a murder or murder-suicide.
Jill, you were the former executive director of the former executive director of the North Carolina Council for Women. Is this something that the Council for Women concentrates on, or is this just a part of what they do through the course of the year?
It's a part, but it's a major part of what they do, because it's an agency of state government that is supposed to give advice to the governor and the legislature on issues impacting women. But a major part of its responsibility is overseeing a $12 million grant program each year, a large part of which focuses on victims of domestic violence.
So that indicates that the government, at least the state government, is aware that this is a major problem. Paint a picture for us of North Carolina. How big a problem is this? I don't know whether you do this with numbers or whether you do it some other way, but how big a problem is this?
Well, there is every county in the state, 100 counties, and everybody in each of those counties does have access to support service if they are in a domestic violence or sexual assault situation. However, not every one of those counties has a shelter. Not every county can afford to keep up a shelter. So in some cases, the shelter is shared between two counties. But every county has some kind of support service for victims of domestic violence. So in that regard, it is widespread across the state enough so that the state government allocate some money each year toward domestic violence.
And the battered women's shelter here, is that Mecklenburg County or is that the city of Charlotte?
Mecklenburg County.
And it's overflowing already. So is that the case at most of these shelters around the state?
Yes.
Yes.
And one of the things about, and believe me, I've worked in this movement for a long time, and I've worked in shelters, and we absolutely need shelters. But this is 35 years now that we've been working on this, and I'd like to see us start to move towards a new model, which we can talk about again in a few minutes.
Okay, Julie Owens is a survivor and Kit Gruelle is a survivor and a national advocate for this. Julie Owens is with us, Jane Taylor and Jill Dinwiddie. But we will continue in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Charlotte Symphony, performing Ravel's Piano Concerto and works by Debussy. Christopher Warren Green conducts Friday and Saturday in the Belk Theater. Tickets at 704-972-2000. And Birdhouse on the Greenway, a bird lover's boutique, providing holistic approach to creating bird and wildlife habitats. Located in Shops at Piper Glen, bringing people and nature together, birdhouseonthegreenway.com. Well, the changing climate is not only altering the temperature and melting glaciers and causing wild weather patterns, it's also changing our behavior. And a new science has emerged to study what we're doing to adapt. One local scientist, for instance, has discovered some fascinating social changes among native Alaskans. We're going to talk about what he's discovered and about a movement called Climate Convergence tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, as members of Congress face voters over recess, President Obama makes the case for stricter gun control laws. The latest on gun control legislation, 3 months after the Newtown tragedy.
Join us for the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about domestic violence in North Carolina and around the country with Kit Gruelle, who's a national advocate for this, for stopping this, and a community educator. Also with us, Julie Owens, a survivor, as is Kit, of domestic violence, survivor and director of the Southern Piedmont Region for the North Carolina Council for Women. Jill Dinwiddie is co-founder of the Enough campaign, and Jane Taylor is the coordinator for the Battered Women's Shelter. You were saying just prior to the break, Kit, that we have been focusing a lot on shelters, but we need to change the paradigm, and there's a new model that's emerging.
Well, it's only right now, there's only one program like this, and it's in Tel Aviv, Israel. And what they decided in Tel Aviv a number of years ago was that it was kind of ridiculous to say to women and children, now that you've been beaten up, now that you've been intimidated, now that you've been terrorized, you also have to go to this hidden place, and you have to leave behind friends, family, schools, pets, jobs, everything, and hide out. And so what they decided to do in Tel Aviv was allow the women and children to stay in their homes, and they build a facility to send abusers to.
Well, the abuser is a criminal, so why aren't they being sent to facilities?
Well, that's a very big question. That's a very big question. I mean, we have one of the issues that I'd like to see us work on in North Carolina is starting to deal more aggressively with domestic violence when it occurs as a misdemeanor. For example, we have a charge in North Carolina called misdemeanor assault with a deadly weapon, mm-hmm. which sounds a little oxymoronic, but it's a charge that gets used a lot, and that means that an abuser can shoot or stab his wife or girlfriend. And most times it's charged as a misdemeanor. And so the message to the victim obviously is profound. The message to the offender is profound. I can beat her, I can shoot her, I can stab her, and there's a real good chance that this is only getting charged as a misdemeanor.
If these people were not in a relationship, mm-hmm. what would the perpetrator be charged with?
Julie?
Well, it could be any number of things, but they would be likely to be charged, first of all. I think a lot of times it doesn't get charged. In fact, it's not even reported to the police. So what we see is just the tip of the iceberg. Here in Mecklenburg County, for example, you said that there were last year 36,000 some odd calls to the police, right? Well, there were 8,000 arrests, and those were for all kinds of things like intimidation, homicide, simple assault, kidnapping. There were some different things, but primarily it's all a misdemeanor domestic violence, even if it could be horrendous injuries, but it's still considered a misdemeanor. So I'm looking at a list of the different categories.
Why? I don't understand. For example. Why is it still considered a misdemeanor?
Well, I don't understand that either. I think it has a lot to do with the way, you know, society looks upon familial relationships and men's relationships to men in particular. And, I mean, women and men's relationship, especially within marriage, because, you know, historically, legally, and even within religion, men have always been the head of the home. They have been, they legally owned their wives and their children until, you know, just over 100 and some odd years ago. And so it takes, you know, years for society to change. Laws may change before ideas do and before paradigm shift. You know, I believe we still have this idea in society, even though people don't necessarily say it, but that men are the heads of the household, that women, the wives do need to do what they say, and that when they don't, they're being disobedient, and that husbands have the right to punish wives. You know, I do a lot in the Christian church because my father's a pastor, and when I went through my terrible episode after I filed for divorce. My father and I were both badly injured. And so I really got interested in what the Bible has to say, for example, and what religions have taught. And I think there's just a lot of confusion, a lot of misinterpretation.
Well, in the evangelical tradition and in many other traditions as well, not to point that one out in particular, but there is this love, honor, and obey.
Right. Yes, exactly.
And you are chattel. I mean, you are to do what the husband says because he is the head of the household. So there is fundamental foundation in church law.
Well, it's interesting because it's not biblical, but it is fundamental in many church teachings. And so I think there are some really important theologians and biblical scholars who are relooking at that now. The RAVE Project, something I work on, which is a website, the Religion and Violence E-Learning Project, funded by the Lilly Endowment, is one of the efforts to try to re-educate and to try to teach seminarians and pastors and so forth what the Bible really says. Because so often scriptures are taken out of context and are misinterpreted. And I think that's what's happened a lot. But for people like myself, for example, who was raised in the Christian church, who believed or who was taught, you know, that, you know, you shouldn't get a divorce, that really does impact your decisions. And so you ask, well, you know, why women stay? Why do they put up with it? Was how you put it. It's not so much that. It's they've been taught that you're not supposed to leave, that if you do leave, then there's something wrong with you. It's your job to stay there and fix the relationship and to work on it. And that's why we have to have we really need a paradigm shift to zero tolerance for abuse of any kind. You know, what we need to be teaching little children from the age, from birth, is gender equality, mutual trust, and respect. Instead of saying, you know, boys will be boys and letting them get away with being bullies and little brutes, mm-hmm. and then, you know, pampering little girls and letting them be gentle and kind and sweet, because boys are like that too when they're little, but then they change. It's what society expects of boys and men. And I think we have to change that and say, look, everybody deserves to be treated with respect.
Go ahead.
I just want to talk a minute about court services, because I don't want us to jump to think that there aren't things in the court system being done here in Charlotte. We run the protection order court every day, all day long. We run a domestic violence criminal court every day, all day long. Safe Alliance's victim assistance program will help over 3,000 individuals a year just receiving restraining orders. And they don't have to come through us to get restraining orders. They can go on their own. So that's the numbers that we're talking about just in this community that are coming through the court system. So we're saying misdemeanors. Well, misdemeanors in North Carolina, if you have assault on a female, that can be a 2-year misdemeanor, up to 2 years of imprisonment. Of course, they don't do that.
Doesn't happen. Right.
Doesn't happen. But I just don't want us to think that we're not addressing through the criminal justice system. We've gotten real good at that for the past 30 years. That's where we put all of our emphasis, on what to do after something happens. We need to get to the front of it, and we need to get to the prevention issue. And in the schools, in the school system, when kids are 3 and 4 years old, to start then, to stop it before it ever happens.
Jill.
Well, two things, actually. One of the things that I have learned about through my work with this Enough Domestic Violence campaign is that Safe Alliance has a team of volunteer attorneys who are trained to help victims when they get into the or before they get into the court system. So, and I think that's really an important part of what Safe Alliance is doing for our community right now. And secondly, going back to the faith community, the Enough campaign is hoping very much to work with the faith community, probably starting with Mecklenburg Ministries and their outreach to the religious entities involved with them, to talk the clergy into discussing with their congregation what marriage is not. And marriage is not about controlling or abusing your partner. It is not about that.
You've spoken, Julie, about, because your father was a pastor and you went through a horrific incident with your former husband, in which included your father, who he tried to kill your father. But you said that you grew up in a Christian household. Your father was a pastor. The issue of spousal abuse or domestic violence never came up, and that you didn't know anything about it until it occurred to you, and that you discovered that even in traditions that would not approve of this, faith traditions that would not approve of this behavior, they didn't know how to handle it. They had no clue how to handle it.
No, not at all. And I think that's what's so interesting. I mean, I had the same stereotypes everybody else does. You know, I thought a battered woman was that woman who she's getting beat up all the time, and she's married to someone who has an anger problem. You know, I bought into all those myths. I thought it was caused by anger or substance abuse and, you know, stress and all of those kinds of things that it's not. I didn't realize it was about power and control and that it wasn't always physical. So when it was happening to me, I knew it was wrong. I knew it wasn't okay. I knew I wasn't going to live like that indefinitely, but I didn't know what it was, and it didn't have a name. And nobody said to me in the church or otherwise, this is abuse. This isn't your fault. This is against the law. You don't deserve to be treated this way, and here's where you can go for help.
Right.
Now, I do think if somebody had said those things to me, I might have reached out to one of these places that could have helped me. But at the time, it wasn't defined, and I think that's what happens a lot. I think people will say, well, that couple just fights a lot.
Let's define it then, because people may not recognize what it is. Define domestic. What are we talking about?
Well, it's a pattern of coercive, controlling behavior that's exercised by one intimate partner over another.
And I also want us to be clear, as we mentioned earlier in the show, that these are tactics. A lot of people, I mean, I'm out around the country a lot doing training, and a lot of people, when I talk to strangers in airports or whatever, those guys are so out of control. And the exact opposite is true. They're not out of control. Mm-hmm. These are strategic and planned behaviors that they use.
So how would we recognize, if you're not being hit, mm-hmm. if you're not being threatened with a knife or some kind of a weapon, if it's just words, if it's intimidation, mm-hmm. if it is belittling, how do you recognize it? How do others recognize it? How do you then get others to say, to help you stop it?
Well, first, it's not just words. I mean, a woman will say to me all the time, you know, he gave me a black eye that healed. Mm-hmm. The words cut me right. completely through my soul. So it's not just words. It's the entire, and the abuse is purposeful.
That's right.
The abuse has laid out purpose. And that purpose is to control. I mean, they don't beat up someone at the bar. Mm-hmm. They don't beat up someone coming home. Mm-hmm. They walk through that door, and then they choose to do it. So it's very much in control, and it's a great stress reliever.
You've all of you have talked about how these people can be really sweet, mm-hmm. particularly initially. And you, I think you asked your husband, why didn't you act like this before the marriage? And he said, you wouldn't have married me.
Yeah.
Can you spot these signs in a relationship before you commit or before you move in together?
Oh, absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely.
I used to go to one of the high schools down in the Durham Chapel Hill area. And we would do these exercises with teenage girls because, you know, teenage girls very much want to be in relationships. They want to have boyfriends. And we would set up this hypothetical where we would say, okay, you've got this boyfriend that you care a lot about. It's Thursday. He wants you to spend the entire weekend together, and she's very excited about that. And then all of a sudden, a friend of hers that has moved away has come back into town, and her friend says, let's go to a movie on Saturday night. So how does your boyfriend respond to that? Does he say, great, go out and have a good time? You know, I know we were supposed to go out, but that's really – I want you to go out and see her. Or does he say, no, you're supposed to be with me? Or does he say, fine, go out and go with her. I'll go find somebody else to go out with. So those are the kinds of things – if you can have those discussions with people early on so that they can start to understand what controlling behaviors look like. Because we are so socialized to look for black eyes and broken noses and things like that. And, you know, I train hostage negotiators in California, and we use the term benign hostage because these behaviors start much, much, much earlier in these relationships. And that's what's so difficult is if we're socialized to only respond to physical violence, then we've missed about 75% of what we need to look at.
Let me give you some examples of benign hostage taking, because this is what my husband did with me. In the first 3 months of marriage before I left him, and we did reconcile for a brief time afterwards before I filed for divorce and the physical violence erupted. But it's like pulling the phone out of the wall when you call for help, taking the spark plugs out of the car if you live out in the country like mm-hmm. I did when I would try to leave. I would try to walk out the door, and he would literally bar the door, you know, stand against the door. Or at one time he did put his hands on me and hold me by the arms. And there are different ways of isolating you. You know, I would go to work. I was teaching school, and he would call all the time to check to make sure I was there. You know, he would accuse me of having affairs. There are different ways to isolate and control. I was being kept up at night. It was complete sleep deprivation.
Embarrassing you in front of your friends if you want to, you know. So what happens? Well, your friends don't come over anymore.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's a totality mm-hmm. of this behavior. And none of that is against the law, really. You know, what are you going to do, right? And a lot of people think, and if you're in that situation and someone has been very loving initially and then they're like this, a lot of us think, well, he must be sick. Why did he change? Something's wrong with him. Well, I'm married in sickness and in health, then I got to help him. So there's that other trap, right? But it's not sickness, because if it was, he would be doing that with everybody. Mm-hmm. And I think that's true, you know, when a lot of times an abuser may drink or use drugs. Well, most of them don't, but when they do, then they are kind of excused for it because of that. But they get just as drunk and just as high with their friends, and they don't beat them up and abuse them. So, again, we really have to look at the instrumental nature of this abusive and controlling behavior. Why do they do it? Because it works. It gets him what he wants.
And I think we also, I think you're right. Yes, you can paint a picture of an abuser. I don't think they're very creative. A lot of them do pretty much the same thing. So there is kind of a characteristic. If we can help and continue help young girls and women understand what the warning signs are, because afterwards when they come to the shelter, and I said, tell me what's going on. Well, you know, had I only known, or had I, you know, in looking back, I can see where I should have paid attention to this or that.
But it's not just girls and women. The majority is girls and women. But you have one man at the shelter.
Yes.
One man at the shelter. And you also used to be with the LGBT, I don't know the exact title.
The Committee of the Domestic Violence.
Committee of Domestic Violence.
How does it differ in that community?
Well, you have to understand that we all get the same messages growing up. We all hear the same thing growing up. In a woman, one in three women will be sexually abused by the time they're grown. That doesn't matter if you're straight or gay. Mm-hmm. One in four women will be physically abused by the time they grow up, and that doesn't matter either. So we're getting the same messages. So women and men are coming along hearing the same thing. So the control issues are there. You're in a same-sex relationship. You still have if you have the control issue, one-upmanship sort of thing, mm-hmm. that you're going to have the same sort of issues coming about.
That's Jane Taylor, who is the coordinator for the Battered Women's Shelter. Also with us, Jill Dinwiddie, co-founder of the Enough Campaign. Kit Gruel is a national advocate. And Julie Owens is the director of the Southern Piedmont Region for the North Carolina Council for Women. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Northeastern University Charlotte, hosting a graduate roundtable information session on April 10th for degrees in finance, leadership, and taxation. Details at northeastern.edu/Charlotte. And Boatsman Gilmore Wagner, certified public accountants, helping companies achieve their financial goals with offices in the Charlotte and Huntersville Lake Norman areas. BoatsmanGilmoreWagner.com. As members of Congress face voters over the spring recess, President Obama makes the case for stricter gun control laws. Diane Rehm and her guests talk about the status of gun control legislation 3 months after the Newtown, Connecticut tragedy. That's coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. If you'd like to join our conversation, 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or online at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
The election is behind us, but you still have a chance to vote. We encourage you to go to WFAE.org and take the listener survey to let us know what you think about the programming on 90.7. Listener feedback is a critical component in our program decision-making process. Please take the opportunity now to tell us what your favorite and not-so-favorite shows are. There's a comment section, too, for you to discuss issues we did not include in the survey. That's all at WFAE.org. Thank you.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about domestic violence. Julie Owens is a survivor, and so is Kit Gruel. Kit Gruel has brought a stack of files here. These files are restraining orders?
These are all restraining orders from 1 year in North Carolina. Now, these are not all the restraining orders that were issued, but these happen to be orders of protection that were pulled by two women reporters in the News and Observer when they were writing a series on domestic violence homicides in North Carolina.
That's about 6 inches tall.
Yeah, there's probably 45 or 50 orders here, and every single one of the women who went to obtain these orders of protection was murdered in precisely the ways that they said they were going to be. So you know, I sometimes refer to restraining orders as a last will and testament because, you know, battered women are the experts in what's happening in their relationship. And we need society. We need to treat them like the experts that they are. When she says, he's going to kill me, or he's going to kill my family, or he's going to kill my cousin if he can't get to me, we have got to step on the brakes and slow down and take that whole thing seriously. And then when there's a restraining order violation, our judicial officials have to understand that he is showing contempt for the court system. And he truly is a risk to her and to the community at large.
And you have the numbers to back that up, because you have numbers on the incident, the number of people who have died because of terrorism, the number of people who died in Afghanistan, the number of people who died in Iraq, and the number of women who have died in America in a similar time period. What are those numbers? They're astounding.
Right. And these are FBI statistics. So during the last political season, there was this term, the war on women. So this is from 9/10/2001 to 6/6/2012. 3,073 people were killed in the terror attacks on 9/11. 2,002 U.S. troops were killed in Afghanistan. Once again, this is from September 10, 2001 to June 6, 2012. 4,486 U.S. troops were killed in Iraq. 11,766 American women were killed by their husbands or boyfriends, more than the above categories combined. And this is this hidden war that no one knows about until there's a murder or a murder-suicide. Sometimes there's a larger public event, like there was last, I think it was in November, when the ex-husband showed up at the beauty parlor in Wisconsin, I think killed 8 or 9 people. But once again, this is why it's so important for us to slow down and listen to these victims/survivors. And when they say, he's going to kill me, we have got to stop and listen.
Let me give you an example of just this. I sit on the Fatality Review Board for Mecklenburg County. We are reviewing fatalities, domestic violence fatalities. We've done it for 2 years now. We're doing it for the state, kind of a pilot project for the state. In each one of the cases that we reviewed, everyone seemed to know about it. The family knew about it. The neighbors knew about it. This person, everyone knew what was going on in these families, in these homes. No one did a single thing. So just the idea that we're still in a belief system that says this is private. This is their business. We stay out of it. I don't want to get involved in that. That's a huge, huge reality.
And I asked a question earlier, why do women put up with it? Why don't they just leave? And Julie, you say that the most dangerous thing a victim can do is to leave mm-hmm. or talk about.
Right.
Yeah, leaving. That's right. Because that is the ultimate, to an abuser, that's the ultimate challenge to the to their power and control. And they will say, and very few battered women that I've met have never heard these words, "If you leave me, I will kill you." And my abuser said, "If you leave me, I will kill you. I will cut your father's eyes out." And that's exactly what he tried to do.
Why would she doubt that? Why would she doubt?
And why is she going to roll the dice on that?
Yeah. Right.
You know, and so I'm one of those who did not go to a shelter, even though I knew it was an option, because I was not going to leave my family at risk.
So what's your advice? Because you're between a rock and a hard place.
Well, you are between a rock and a hard place. First of all, don't think that the criminal justice system can keep you safe. And I think that's one of the things that victims, that's one of the options, one of the tools is to get a restraining order, to, you know, try to get him arrested. But that doesn't necessarily make you safer. It could actually increase the danger. So what victims need to do is go to a trained domestic violence advocate somewhere like Safe Alliance, have them do a safety plan with them. That's sitting down and working out the details of how they may proceed in a manner that is safest for them, because everybody's situation is different. But every victim needs a safety plan that is an ongoing a process. It's not just a document. It's a process. My safety plan went for 25 years until my abuser died this year. I had to make sure that everything I did took into consideration the fact that he might still want to kill me. So, you know, it's not over when you leave. As long as that abuser is alive, there's the possibility, if they really want to punish you for leaving them or, in their minds, ruining their life, ironically, then, you know, safety planning becomes what you do for the rest of your life.
And that safety planning has to include working with women who are not going to leave.
Exactly.
I mean, because we have to allow them to be the experts and the one to determine when to walk out that door.
How safe are they in the battered women's shelter?
Well, I mean, it's a good question because luckily most shelters are safe and secure facilities. But the sad truth is a number of years ago, there was a woman in Jackson County, Bonnie Woodring, whose abuser stalked her to the shelter.
Yeah.
And one of the shelter workers walked out, and he stormed into the kitchen, shot and killed her in the shelter.
Right, in front of her
child. So we, you know, once again, we can never underestimate the determination of abusers to exact the most profound revenge, which is homicide, sometimes murder-suicide. And the other thing that I'm very happy to learn is that on top of the safety planning, there have to be lethality assessments, and there's a new tool that's just been developed or it's been developed in the last few years that law enforcement are now using. It's a lethality assessment tool that they can use on the scene. It started in Maryland. It started with the work of Jackie Campbell, who's at Johns Hopkins. And now across the country, there are more and more law enforcement officers who are using this lethality assessment tool to help make a determination as to which ones of these cases have the potential to become deadly.
We're doing that here in Charlotte.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's been very successful.
We started doing that in November, and it's been overwhelming the number of calls that we got at first, because this is the earliest intervention that a lot of women have ever had where an officer is saying, "Whoa,
right.
I am really, really concerned about you. I want you to talk to someone at our shelter and talk some safety with them."
And yet there was a recent article in the New York Times about guns and the involvement of guns in all of this, and that in many states the gun ownership rights outflank the need for safety in these situations.
Well, the availability of guns. I mean, if you're arguing, the availability of guns has added a sense to this that is just unprecedented.
Well, and
you can reach over and grab a gun at any time during the night and shoot someone.
And there's in this New York Times article, which I encourage your listeners to go. This is March 17th, 2013. This is just one of the best articles I've ever seen. And one of the things that stood out to me is the NRA says that they don't want guns taken away from abusers that don't have felony convictions. Well, the majority around the country, not just in North Carolina, around the entire country, the majority of the convictions, if there are convictions, are misdemeanor convictions, which means that the NRA is completely comfortable with these abusers who have said to her and said to her family, said to the neighbors, whatever, if she leaves me, I'll kill her. And so there's this lack of understanding of the profound lethality issues that battered women face at the hands of an abuser who feels entitled to control her and will use a gun to demonstrate to her that if he can't have her, no one can. Mm-hmm. And I get feeds every day on my computer. Women killed, or murder suicide. I mean, we seem to have this epidemic of murder suicides in North Carolina and around the country. And I think it's our belief, for those of us sitting here at this table, the majority of those are preventable.
Yes. And it's not about a mental health concern. And I think a lot of times when you hear, especially these mass murders where a lot of people are killed at once, or when someone kills the children as well, that we immediately go to, this person is mentally ill. That is usually not the case.
Right.
Typically, people who are mentally ill don't tend to do these types of things. These are folks who probably don't even have a mental health diagnosis, but they have said, you know, if you leave me, I will kill you and maybe the children. And so we need to understand this is not going to be fixed. It's not that domestic violence and mental health and substance abuse and all those things aren't correlated, but it's not causative.
So as we sit around the table and be talking about all these situations, you, Jill, are in charge of this Enough is Enough campaign. When you hear all these, and I'm not sure this is not the first time you've heard all these things, but when you hear all these things, how do you direct a campaign like that? How do you do it and keep victims safe, et cetera?
Well, our objective is to educate the public about the pervasiveness of domestic violence and to educate potential victims about the resources that are available to them in the community, and then to inspire those victims to seek help before it's too late, and to inspire the public to not stand on the sidelines any longer, but to open themselves up as friends and listeners and advocates for the people involved.
And there's one thing that I want to say, too. The reality of it is there are a lot of people that just don't care about domestic violence.
Mm-hmm.
They think it doesn't affect me, it doesn't affect my family, it doesn't happen in my neighborhood. But the reality of it is we're all paying for it in one
That's
way
right.
or another. A number of years ago, I went to one of the law schools in the Triangle to do a talk, and it was going to be a large audience, and I knew there were going to be people in the audience that didn't particularly care or
mm-hmm.
feel affected by domestic violence. But everyone is worried about budgetary issues. So this was a long, long time ago. I think in 1992, the Duke Endowment did a study to find out how much it cost to adjudicate a death penalty case in North Carolina. And it was, if I remember right, it was $2.6 million per case. I had a friend who at the time was working at the Capitol Defender's Office, and I called him and I said, how many of the guys that you're working with were exposed to domestic violence as children? He said, all of them. So I went to the Department of Corrections website to see how many people at the time we had on death row, 213. So you multiply 213 times in 1992 dollars, $2.6 million, it's a lot of money. Mm-hmm. That's just the capital cases. That's not the first-degree cases. That's not the second-degree cases. So we are, as a society, reacting to this crime. We're losing people, we're losing treasure, and we, those of us that do this work and have this passion for ending this violence, recognize that, yes, we want to stop violence against women and children, we want to stop violence in our communities, but there's all kinds of other reasons why it's important to do it, because we are wasting, I don't mean wasting in a bad way, we're just spending so much money reacting to this crime.
Put your headphones on. We'll take a couple of phone calls before we run out of time here. We'll begin with William in Charlotte. William, welcome. You're on WFAE.
Hi, I appreciate you taking my call. I happen to be tuned in this morning here in this discussion, and I just had to call and say something. First of all, let me preface what I'm saying by any woman or man who's been...
William, I'm going to ask you to be very quick because we're really short on time.
Okay. Well, I just want to tell you that the domestic violence law has been severely abused by people taking divorce actions in the last 15 years. And I was called into court about 15 years ago, and I thought, there's no need for me to hire an attorney because I've done nothing wrong. And I was accused of committing domestic violence. I had never assaulted my wife in the 23-year marriage. There was no police record of her ever calling the police because I assaulted her.
I'm going to stop you there because I've read about this happening, and this is what kind of goes to the question I asked earlier in the program. How do you prove this? And it could be used against people unfairly.
This has been the what's come about every time we've made any kind of progress, particularly in North Carolina. When we helped get rid of the marital rape issue back in
93.
You know, it was said that, oh, women are going to rush to the court and accuse all of their husbands of rape. Never happened. The idea that women are going to come flying into the courtroom and want divorce and want this and that because of it, it doesn't happen that way.
Well, the fact is that victims mostly are not telling anybody that it's happening and because they're afraid to.
Mm-hmm.
And so
But it can be abused. I mean, a woman could, or even a man.
It could be, of course, and I'm sure it does happen at times. Mm-hmm. But most of the time what we see is that the tables are turned on the victim by the abuser claiming to be the victim. And we see a lot of women being arrested for abuse when they're in fact the victim. So we see much more of that sort of abuse of the system than the other.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller on the line I don't have time to take, Ann, who wanted to talk about male victims. And I know that in Charlotte, 26% of domestic violence victims are men, and that is higher than the national average. And you're shaking your head, no, that's not true?
Well, again, as I said, that just means that women were arrested for abusing men. But what we know as Gavin DeBecker, a writer, says, it might be statistically correct to think of or politically correct to think of domestic violence in terms of gender neutrality, but it's statistically incorrect. So most of those women get an arrest date or victim.
And in one word, are these numbers underreported?
Absolutely.
Yes, they're underreported.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Probably 7 to 8 times worth.
Okay. Julie Owens is a survivor director of the Southern Piedmont region of the North Carolina Council for Women. Jane Taylor is with the Battered Women's Shelter. Jill Dinwiddie is the co-founder of the Enough Campaign. And Crit Grewell is a national advocate against this kind of violence. Thank you.